This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with an authority on the situation in Iran.
Are we seeing another setup like Iraq? Do you think Iran has or is developing nuclear weapons? Do you think they want to abolish Israel? You'd be wrong.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, once again we see Twitter in the news, Twitter about activists, Twitter about subpoenas, and again, our question is, how protected are our tweets? So Heidi, what happened in New York recently on this issue?
Michael, last week, an Occupy Wall Street protester who had been arrested in October on the Brooklyn Bridge trap and arrest, he received a subpoena on January 26th from the Manhattan DA's office seeking user information, including email address, and 3 months, get that, 3 months worth of tweets from his handle. It's at @DestructureMall. The activist's name is Malcolm Harris.
Question first. You said he received the subpoena. He was someone who was on the Brooklyn Bridge. You said he received the subpoena. But was it he who received the subpoena, or was it Twitter that received the subpoena?
Prosecutors subpoenaed Twitter.
So they went to Twitter, and they said to Twitter, give us all of his IP addresses and everything, which I understand, and there's a law about allowing you to do that. But they also asked Twitter for 3 months of substance of this guy's actual tweets?
Correct. And I know you think that's not possible, but it seems that's what's happened.
I may be dead wrong. We want to go back to this, but I only have my experience helping represent Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, really, with regard to Twitter. And what the government, the United States government, subpoenaed from Twitter was the IP addresses that were used under any accounts that might have been registered to WikiLeaks. They didn't actually ask for the substance of the tweets, which, to get the substance of the tweets, you actually would need a court order under the Fourth Amendment, because it's actually substance. It's not just the technical, like, telephone number you called or the IP addresses. So my question here is, and I read the news article along with you, and we can get the attorney on to discuss this. It appears that they're not only going for the IP addresses, which are the computers things are sent from and where they go, et cetera, but they're actually asking for the substance of the tweets.
But Michael, I think tweets are different from emails. They're shorter and they go out to hundreds or thousands of people at the same time. It's public.
That's a very good point. So maybe they're not protected, because couldn't I just go on whatever this person's website is and look
at all
his tweets?
Well, you could follow him. Now, you tell me that you were a big tweeter yourself, so you know that you follow people, and so you would get his tweets whenever he sent things or retweeted things, you'd get them. And they can only be a certain number of characters, so they're short.
140 characters.
140 characters.
How many characters are in a haiku? No, I don't remember.
But anyway, let me just add that Twitter has confirmed, they are based in San Francisco, their company's policy is, quote, to notify users about law enforcement and governmental requests for their information unless we're prevented by law from doing so. And they say that's to protect users' rights. So what's happened is, while the motion to quash is being considered and Guild member Martin Stoller is representing Malcolm Harris in this case, they're not going to comply with the subpoena while Marty Stoller prepares the motion to quash.
One question which I don't know the answer to, because you guys make a good point on the tweets are public, so you can go look at them, anybody can look at them, is how long they are up for. So can I look at my tweets from 3 months ago? Or can I just look at my tweets for the last week or 2 weeks? I don't know the answer to that.
Compelling question, Michael.
We don't know. So I think this is an important story because, again, we have subpoenas to Twitter. Twitter at least notifying people, much like they did with the Assange case. They eventually did notify people. We ultimately lost the motion to quash those IP addresses. But ultimately, this case will again be a precedent-setting, very important case.
It will, and I think it'll also shine light on Twitter as a company to see. Now, they've wisely said they're not going to turn anything over during the preparation, but I would hope they'd fight this and resist turning it over.
They look at themselves as a neutral party, like a stakeholder. You know, anyway,
yeah.
Like just someone out there and let the other two people fight about it.
And we want to remind listeners that after the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, Marty Stoller also represented the activist who had been sending tweets about the whereabouts of police as activists and police were winding their ways through the streets of Pittsburgh. So Marty is becoming expert in Twitter representation.
Right. Marty actually won that case, as I recall. Now, a lot going on with Twitter. I think people should actually, you can go to Twitter and follow some people, particularly people from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who are constantly tweeting about what Twitter is doing, how that it's now going to follow the local rules in different countries, which means that it's going to be censoring tweets, all kinds of things. We don't want to do a long thing on it here. We may at some point, but Electronic Frontier Foundation, go to their tweets.
Now, the next update we have deals with the fact that it seems in retaliation for hackers who claim credit for attacking the U.S. Justice Department's website. And as you know, Wikipedia and Craigslist shut down their sites, or they put notices up in protest of the proposed Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IPX that didn't pass. It seems that the government is retaliating. They shut down the popular and large file-sharing website Mega Upload. It had 150 million registered users and about 50 million hits a day. It was huge. But the U.S. government shut the site down a couple of weeks ago, and they arrested three Mega Upload employees in New Zealand on U.S. accusations that they facilitated millions of illegal downloads of films, music, and other content. Now, the government says this cost copyright holders at least $500 million in lost revenue, although Mega Upload had high-profile support from celebrities and other content producers, musicians, Kim Kardashian, Alicia Keys, Kanye West, and others. In a related case, and this all, I'm going to tie it back in a minute to Electronic Frontier Foundation, but the U.S. is trying to extradite British student Richard O'Dwyer over alleged copyright breach. He's a 23-year-old student who created a now-defunct TV Shack website, which allowed users to watch film and TV programs free of charge. A court ruled last month that he could be sent to the U.S. for trial. His attempted extradition, the shutting down of Mega Upload, and here's where Electronic Frontier Foundation comes in, because they recently issued a statement calling the arrests related to Mega Upload, quote, a terrifying precedent. If the U.S. can seize a Dutch citizen in New Zealand over a copyright claim, what is next? And I think what this shows is that even though those two laws did not pass the online piracy legislation, the government's still barging ahead and doing essentially what it would have wanted to do had the legislation passed. They're arresting people.
I did read the article that you're, or at least the series that you're referring to, and it was done immediately after the defeat of SOPA and the other statute was...
It's the PIPA, Protect IP.
Right, PIPA. So I did read that they went immediately after that. So it does sound like it's in retaliation for it. Now, it's interesting that the British court ordered his extradition. I'm sure there'll be appeals. The case you just mentioned about the attempt to extradite Richard O'Dwyer, it reminds me of the case of Gary McKinnon, who tried to crack in or did crack into a NSA computer to supposedly look at pictures of UFOs or something that they were allegedly hiding from the public. And he is living in England now, and the U.S. has been trying to extradite him for 8 years and has not gotten him yet. Just like with Richard O'Dwyer, I think there's huge support for McKinnon and O'Dwyer to resist extradition to the United States on these crimes.
But unfortunately for O'Dwyer, on January 13th, a UK magistrate ruled that he can be extradited. And interestingly enough, it's the Southern District of New York, TV Shack. So the Southern District Court of New York has charged him with conspiracy to commit copyright infringement and also criminal infringement of copyright. Each has a maximum sentence of 5 years.
So there are two important cases in England. As you said, this was a magistrate, which is the lowest level in England.
So it will be appealed.
Yeah, there's many years ahead, I would hope, for resisting the extradition. But as you can see, the world is changing, and the offensive by the people to get information is being met with, you know, criminality by the governments.
Michael, you've been away, so we haven't really talked about recent developments in New York City pertaining to the film The Third Jihad, which was shown to New York City police officers. And aside from the repugnant nature of this film, it also revealed a police department that has lied publicly about what they used in their training materials.
The Third Jihad was a film that was supposedly shown to only a few policemen, a dozen or two dozen. That was the original story, because when it came out, it was incredibly embarrassing for the police department and for the city. Here they showed, and with a broad brush, really, tarred and feathered, Islam in particular, Muslim community, etc. They even had a picture, apparently, of the White House with a flag of Islam over the White House. They had pictures of the massacre in Russia, all that kind of stuff.
So let's just clarify this. This is not depiction of actual things. They fabricated, for example, that flag scene. So this is propaganda in its finest form.
This was propaganda. And when I first heard the story, I said, what? This can't be true. And of course, you put it in context of what you and I and the show have been discussing since the beginning of 9/11, you know, the roundup of Muslims in the city, the fingerprinting of Muslims, the entrapment of Muslims,
Islamophobia,
the stopping of the building of the Muslim center in downtown New York, just huge waves of Muslim phobia all over the city. And of course, then we had a story a few weeks ago that talked about
infiltration,
police department infiltrating mosques and schools and taking the names of all the Muslims, et cetera, et cetera. So we're talking about an incredibly serious attack on Muslims. And in this, all of a sudden comes this film and the Third Jihad. And the first thing we hear about the film only showed to 25 people. Is that right?
This came out as a result of something we're seeing with more and more regularity due to government secrecy, the use of the Freedom of Information Act. So it was requested and made public through that.
But of course, they lied in the Freedom of Information Act, or they redacted the parts that showed how many people it was shown.
Right.
Because when the story first surfaced by the people who requested the Freedom of Information Act request, who made the Freedom of Information Act request, it was only, you know, a couple of dozen people.
Right.
And they
downplayed it.
Right. And our police chief claimed not to know anything about it.
Right.
The police department spokesman, Paul Brown, essentially lied about it. And then it came out that it wasn't shown to just one person, not 10 people, not 100 people, but 1,489 officers. And as the community has said, as activists have said, those people, those officers, police officers, are now walking the city with poison in their brains. In other words, when they see Muslims, when they see anybody, they're going to think Third Jihad, poison in their brains. And the problem to me right now is, what's been the reaction in the city? I was saying to myself when I saw it, had this been against another minority? Had this been against the Irish? Had it been against Italians? Had it been against
Armenians?
Had it been against Jews? There would have been thousands of people in the streets.
Outrage.
Ray Kelly would have lost his job. The press guy would have lost his job. I mean, it's outrageous.
Well, but Michael, that's a really frightening statement, I think, because the fact that we don't have this popular uprising in the streets, to me, is an indication of how Islamophobic, fear-mongering tactics have actually maybe be partially come to be accepted, just the way sort of torture is portrayed in the media. And these communities are used to being relegated to second-class citizen and characterized in some aspects as potential terrorists, which is a terrible indictment on our system in New York City, which is supposed to be a liberal urban area.
You know, what's interesting about what you say, I agree that it's been essentially accepted. And even if our fine mayor Bloomberg condemned what happened in the use of the Third Jihad to train police officers, remember, train police officers, it's just words. The answer to stopping Islamophobia is to take action. And the action that would have shown that we're serious in this city about Islamophobia and don't accept it would have been to fire the police chief and the spokesperson and get to the bottom of it. And then, as some of the people who opposed obviously this, the Muslim community, said, there's now 1,489 police officers who have to be retrained. retrain those people now.
And Michael, is that even possible? I mean, of course, I think we need to do that. It's the only responsible thing to do. But once you have searing images in your head filled with hate, it's very hard to undo that.
Oh, and
we should mention that there have been, as of this airing, two protests, I think, on the last past Fridays calling for the resignation of our police commissioner. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think we need to keep the pressure up. Our New York City National Lawyers Guild has a Muslim Defense Committee, and we're actively going out and meeting with Muslim communities. But I think, finally, what we've done to the Muslim community in the wake of 9/11, it's understandable why people don't want to, say, risk engaging in civil disobedience. I mean, who wants to face the specter of being locked up or disappeared for
or beaten.
Acting
out? I mean,
or
if beaten. You're particularly if you're Muslim.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're looked at as starting with criminality, starting with someone who wants to carry out, quote, the third jihad,
right.
Starting with someone who's trying to supposedly impose Islam on the world. I mean, cops who've been shown this movie, they're going to, like, say,
right.
We don't care about this guy. Let's beat the heck out of him. And so it's a serious problem.
Michael, we should remind listeners that we actually did a segment called Fear, Inc., a study on the roots of Islamophobia, a few months ago, and it's available on our website.
And that this is an ongoing, serious problem, and it doesn't seem to be getting better. That's what I can't get over. The fact that the mayor did not fire the police commissioner and the press spokespeople, who not only lied, but actually trained people with a really prejudicial, outrageous film.
It's unconscionable.
Right, it's
and
unconscionable.
This from the so-called New York's finest. Michael, it's been years that we've been talking about the 171 individuals who remain at Guantanamo, and now we have a piece of news, a glimmer of hope, that five may be released.
Glimmer of hope is an interesting word, Heidi, because if we've talked about it on this show many times, of the 171, 89 have been cleared for release. That means that the United States, even the United States government, doesn't think they should be held at all. So what are they doing there? That's been part of our other shows, etc. But now, all of a sudden, we get the news that five detainees, are going to be released. But you would think, well, they're going to be our Uyghurs who were cleared for release or somebody
right.
like that. But no, they're the people who have been kept in Guantanamo for indefinite detention, who the United States believes should be at Guantanamo because they're incredibly dangerous. That's what the United States says. So they're going to free them. And who are they? They're five members of the Taliban. Now, think about that. We have 89 people who are cleared, Uyghurs and all these other people. And the United States, in the next few weeks, maybe sooner, is going to release five people. Why are they going to release them? Because they're beginning negotiations with the Taliban, or they have been for a while. The Taliban has opened an office in Qatar, the country in the Middle East, and the five Taliban people will be released into Qatar. I mean, it's the craziest.
In exchange for what?
I don't know what. I mean, maybe the Taliban said we're not negotiating unless we get our five people out of there. Now, I'm not saying those five guys should be in or not.
Right.
But when you look at the allegations the U.S. has made, at least against one of them, the guy apparently was involved in.
Well, and compared to the many individuals, majority, who never deserve to be there in the first place.
It just stands the whole system on its head. If 89 cleared and we're releasing five guys who the U.S. claims are dangerous and should remain there. So, and it just doesn't because the United States one day says, well, we need to negotiate with the Taliban because we're getting killed in Afghanistan. So we better release these five guys, but not the Uyghurs who are just
right.
sitting there.
In limbo.
They've given a closed conference to a number of the members of the House and the Senate who react with different levels of outrage. I mean, Levin says, well, we got to get the stories going. McCain says it's outrageous. We're releasing people who killed Americans. But in any case, what you see the U.S. doing is taking human beings, the ones that they consider dangerous, using them as bargaining chips, and the others, 89, are rotting in Guantanamo. It just shows the utter duplicity, hypocrisy, and inhumanity of our country.
Michael, once again, in the brutal, depressing New York January, you took off and went to the Sundance Film Festival, leaving us back here to report on civil liberties. Why were you at Sundance?
Why? Well, I went to see some of the most amazing documentaries that always get me going because of what an outrage happens in the world, but particularly this country. In fact, one of my friends who was from Canada said to me, says, Michael, you know, I come to Sundance every year, and when I leave, I just hate America. Because what you see are documentaries about what America is doing in the world. I saw a lot of very good ones. I saw a couple on Palestine and Israel that were extraordinary. One called The Law in These Parts, which actually won the Sundance Jury Award for Best Foreign Documentary. And to just sum it up briefly, what it is it takes out of the words of Supreme Court judges who were interviewed from Israel, as well as military judges, and it starts off by showing that these judges say that the courts are there to protect people, that it come between the state and the people, and these are prominent judges. And then it talks about what law they've applied in the occupied territories. And it is devastating because it's out of the mouths of these judges who say we are to protect people that you see two things. One is you see how the Supreme Court of Israel, which has all of this credibility in the, quote, enlightened liberal world, tremendous amount of credibility, you see that the court is not just not credible, but that that very reputation allows it to confirm the taking of Palestinian land at the first, so that time after time, cases come up when people in the West Bank, Palestinians, have lost their land, and time after time, the Supreme Court of Israel confirms the theft of that land. So at the first level, the court is confirming theft, and the filmmaker shows it through various decisions and interviews with the court. And so it just makes the court look really not just a rubber stamp, but worse, part of the instrument of oppression of the Palestinians. I want to say that again. The Supreme Court of Israel is part of the instrument of the oppression of Palestinians, first on the theft of land, and secondly on detention. So the second important aspect concerns administrative detention, lack of trials, and torture. And by the middle to the end of the film, it's clear that the judges who were deciding these cases, both military judges and Supreme Court case judges, knew about the torture of thousands of Palestinians and sat there and did nothing. So we see basically the court just torn to shreds.
Now, Michael, what remedy, if any, is there? Can these judges be tried in the International Criminal Court?
I'm afraid not, Heidi. Apart from Israel not being a member of the International Criminal Court. And, you know, they're carrying out their judicial duty, supposedly. But it is an extraordinary look at a court that has been a sacred cow for law professors and the United States, the Supreme Court of Israel. And you could say that, yes, the Supreme Court of Israel protects rights for Jews living in Israel, not for Arabs living in Israel, not for Palestinians living in Israel, and certainly not for Palestinians in the West Bank. One interesting thing about the film, the fact that it won the Grand Jury Prize for Best Foreign Documentaries demonstrates the shift that's going on in the country about what people think about Israel and what it's doing, particularly in the West Bank. So it'll come to New York. It's going to be an important film. It was extraordinary.
What was it called?
The Law in These Parts.
All right, we'll look for it. And was there anything, Michael, on BDS? Boycott, divest, sanction?
Only, you know, in a lateral way. And last week, interestingly, I'll talk about it next week, I went to the BDS conference in Philadelphia, the national conference. And we'll have a talk about that. It's the Boycott, Divest, Sanction movement against Israel. And it's getting a lot more support. The film that had a lateral effect on it was they showed a film, Heidi, that I think you would just go completely bananas with anger about. I mean, not bananas. You'd just be totally angry. It's called Under African Skies, and it commemorated the 25th anniversary of Paul Simon making the album Graceland. Now, Graceland is, you know, different people have different opinions and what he may have taken from Africa and he shouldn't have and all this, or South Africa, but it's actually an album that most people really like. It's very affirming, great music. This is a film 25 years after the release. Paul Simon goes back to South Africa to encounter the musicians he worked with and other people. And of course, the entire film is really, in my view, about one thing, and that's to justify Paul Simon breaking the boycott against South Africa when he went to record parts of that album in South Africa. And if you look at it, it's one-sided. Actually, one of the producers is Paul Simon's brother. It's very well done, of course. And it makes the argument, and Paul Simon comes off as just doesn't understand anything about politics, except that he's an artist. And who is the United Nations, which had imposed the boycott, along with the ANC, who were they to tell an artist what he can do? And so all the dialogues are about, I'm an artist, and look what I did with the album. And it's true. After he recorded it, it became arguably an anti-apartheid struggle because it got South African musicians into the mainstream. But that's besides the point, because it could have been a total failure.
Right.
The real point was a major musician like Paul Simon went to South Africa, broke the boycott, mm-hmm. and is now making a film under the African skies that justifies artists breaking the boycott. So I bring it forward to the boycott today of Israel. It sends a terrible message.
I want to ask, was there a protest at the screening?
Please, most of the people at the screening would have disagreed with me. Most of the people, because it's so one-sided, would have said, well, Paul Simon has his point. The record, the CD was a great success. And there is some argument that, you know, like Mandela did invite Simon back in 92 when he became the president. And so there's an argument they make, well, they've forgiven him for it. But in fact, he never really apologizes for it. And the fact that now he became popular and they invite him back does not take away from the thrust of that movie, which is artists are artists and they can do whatever they want.
And you know what, Michael? I think any great work of literature or art needs to have both sides. There needs to be a tension that makes it only a better work of art. So,
well, there was some, people would argue there was some tension, but they never really showed the place of the boycott and the embargo in how the South Africa struggle was won.
Right.
They talked about just that there was such a thing, but when you look at what Mandela said after apartheid ended, he said boycott, divestment, sanction was crucial, and it was crucial not necessarily economically, although that was very important. It was crucial also because it isolated South Africa. And what Simon did was by going there was end the isolation of
right.
South Africa,
right.
thereby harming the anti-apartheid movement. Heidi, we know over the last few weeks we've been covering what's happening with Mamiya. We know he got taken off of death row, that he got his death sentence removed, that he's now serving a life sentence. He then got moved to a medium security prison, but he got put into very bad conditions, into solitary in that prison. And we've been asking people to write about that, to protest about it. And now we have an update, and I think it's a good one, but I want to hear from you, Heidi.
I think this is an example, Michael, in which pressure from the public, and there was enormous pressure on the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania, to move Mumia out of the hole, solitary confinement, administrative custody, where he was for 50 days after leaving death row at SCI Green, and it finally worked.
The hole is 23 hours of walls. 23 hours of walls.
It's been likened to spending time alone in a small bathroom.
Oh, my gosh.
Over 5,000 signatures on a petition were gathered in a matter of days, calling for the DOC to move him into general population. As of this airing last week, he was finally moved into general population.
Well, that's really wonderful news. I mean, in a very heroic struggle. I mean, we still have to get him out, but this has been remarkable, and to finally have that achieved is amazing. When's your next visit, Heidi?
As we tape this, went in the next day to see him for the first time in general population. So I look forward to reporting on that visit.
Oh, that's very exciting.
It's
the first time ever.
Visit.
A contact
yes.
visit.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Well, that's really great, and we'll report on it next week. Thank you, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. accusing the Iraqi government of stockpiling weapons of mass destruction as a pretext for a military invasion, Israeli and U.S. intelligence are asserting that Iran is bent on becoming a nuclear weapons state by enriching uranium. As many listeners know, this narrative has been going on for two decades. In a New York Times article titled Confronting Iran in a Year of Elections, New York Times chief Washington correspondent David Sanger platformed his article on the assumption that there is evidence that Iran is making nuclear weapons. We talk today with Professor Bill Beeman, author of The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. Beeman has criticized the New York Times and other media for falsely claiming there is evidence Iran is developing nuclear weapons. He also points out that Iran has a right to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes and that their facilities are monitored by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Professor Beeman is the chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota.
Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
Now, there's a lot of misinformation in the media about Iran and a nuclear threat.
Yes.
How is this country getting it wrong?
First of all, it's very important to understand that there is no evidence anywhere that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. Every report from the International Atomic Energy Agency has reaffirmed that Iran has not diverted any nuclear material for military purposes, including the last report in November. The news media has, especially the New York Times, I must tell you, has distorted the IAEA report in order to make it seem as if Iran is actually building nuclear weapons when we have no evidence to the contrary.
Now, that goes to two questions I have right away that makes me think. One is I agree about the New York Times and the role they're playing, drumbeats of war, like much like they did with Iraq. There was an article that you mentioned in, I think, one of your pieces was the New York Times Magazine article last week.
Yes, that's not only me, but the New York Times Magazine article written by an Israeli journalist has actually attracted hundreds and hundreds of objections because of its warmongering tone and because it contains a lot of inaccuracies. The most recent event is today, is Eric Schmidt's reporting of James Clapper's testimony before Congress. Not only was the testimony before Congress outrageous, but Eric Schmidt's reporting on the event was also outrageous. Clapper tries to claim that Iran is likely to attack the United States based on the incident that took place a few months ago, where a used car salesman from Corpus Christi, Texas, was identified as trying to mastermind a plot to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States. I don't know what's happened to Mr. Arbab Siyar, this gentleman. He had not been indicted before the U.S. government began to claim that Iranian officials were involved. But Clapper's testimony said probably Ayatollah Khamenei knew about it. He has no evidence.
Who's Clapper again?
He's the director of National Intelligence.
I remember reading about that incident, and the fact that Clapper cited that in the congressional testimony and Schmidt reported it is incredible. So one thing you've said is that there's no evidence that they're building a bomb or they have any intent to build a bomb.
That's correct.
But on the other hand, everybody agrees that they're enriching uranium.
Yes, of course, and so are 20 other countries who are signatories to the National the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
And they're allowed to do that.
Oh, they're of course allowed to do that, because in the preamble to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, it states as that all signatories have the inalienable right to develop nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
As medical purposes.
Well, no, medical purposes, generation of electricity, all sorts of things. And that includes enrichment of uranium, because you can't generate electricity unless you have enriched uranium to put in your electricity generating plants. And there are some countries, like Japan, for instance, who have said outright that they intend to develop the capacity to construct nuclear weapons in the future if they need to. And so they've blatantly declared it. Iran has said that it does not intend to do this. The United States is not coming after Japan or Brazil, which is that have issued a similar statement, or any of the other 20 countries that don't have weapons but are now actively enriching uranium. So Iran says, why are you singling us out? You're singling us out because we're wrong. You're not singling us out because what we're doing is necessarily dangerous. And as I, not only the International Atomic Energy Agency, but also our own national intelligence estimate from 2007 and again in 2011, reasserted that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program.
I mean, can you draw some parallels with what happened with Iraq?
Well, yes, of course. And, you know, I mean, I'm a little part of history here. When Colin Powell went before the United Nations declaring that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, I wrote a column saying that it was just simply not true. There's no evidence at all that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That got me on the Bill O'Reilly show, where I had a big, long argument with him about this. And I said, simply show us the actual proof. My feeling was at the time that Colin Powell had been very badly misused by the Bush administration because of his bona fides with the international community. And so Colin Powell delivering the message was going to carry a lot more weight with the international community than anybody else. And it turned out that he had been very badly used by the Bush administration in order to sell a false picture of what was actually going on in Iraq. And as you know, the rest is history. We invaded Iraq.
What I read is that they're enriching uranium up to about 20%, whatever that means.
Well, Iran was given a uranium many years ago during the time of the Shah to use in a medical reactor to develop isotopes for the treatment of cancer. 2 years before the construction of before they started enriching uranium again to a 20% level, Iran went back to the United States and they said our supply that had been given to us before for these medical purposes has been depleted. And we need this in order to treat cancer. There are 800,000 cancer patients a year in Iran that need this treatment. Would you sell us some more 20% enriched uranium in order to fuel our reactors to generate these isotopes? And the United States refused. And so Iran said, well, we need the material. If we can't get it from the U.S., we're going to enrich the uranium ourselves. They then began to enrich uranium to the 20% level for the use in these medical reactors. Now, having refused to give a 20% enriched uranium to Iran, the United States immediately turned around and said, well, if you're enriching uranium to the 20% level, it must mean you're building a bomb. And the two things do not follow from each other. Iran was very clear about its intent, about its purposes, and not only that, every scrap of uranium that they've been working with is under inspection.
That's what I can't get over. Why don't you tell us what that means?
It means that there are IAEA inspectors that have every scrap of uranium catalog written down, and they're watching the process as it goes on every single day. So this is not a situation where Iran is doing this in secret, where they're doing it without knowledge of the international community. And yet, you know, if you look at the reporting on this, you would think that that it's all being done in some horrible clandestine way. It's the duty of the International Atomic Energy Agency to monitor the use of fissile material to make sure that the provision in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty that nations not develop nuclear weapons is not violated.
So it does seem clear from your writings, from your facts, this is just a made-up story. And they couple it with another story, and it's what makes the threat, I guess, so great in people's minds if you ask them about wiping out Israel. Now, can you address that a little bit?
Yes, indeed. This particular story stems from 2005. The last Friday in the month of Ramadan is called the Day of Jerusalem. And at that time in 2005, President Ahmadinejad was addressing a forum of youthful Iranians. And in that, he quoted Ayatollah Khomeini from 1978. The quote was, I can give it to you in Persian, maybe it'll be useful for somebody. In esteghlal yare quotes az ruzegar mahsharad.
Not bad.
Which means in general translation, it's a suppositional, subjunctive statement. And it means someday the occupiers of Jerusalem may disappear from the pages of history.
Right.
And or may someday the occupiers of Jerusalem disappear from the pages of history. It is not. It does not say Israel must be wiped off the map.
It doesn't say we'll do it. It's just saying sometime in the future.
Sometime in the future. It may happen, or may it happen sometime in the future.
Right.
There are two possible interpretations. This was taken, it was mistranslated, and it has now become some kind of doctrine that the government of Iran has threatened to wipe Israel off the map. There's no context given to this statement. It was, as I say, a speech given to during the month of Ramadan, during a religious month, to a closed assembly, not even of government officials, happened to be said by the president, and it wasn't even his own words. It was a quote from 1978, which nobody paid any attention to until President Ahmadinejad said it again, quoted it again in 2005. This is an absolutely ridiculous use of, frankly, propaganda in order to try to make Iran seem like they're about to attack Israel. And people go farther than that. They say if Iran wants to wipe Israel off the map, they're probably going to use their nuclear weapons to do so.
I'd like to ask if you could address the United States' non-response to a recent assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan.
There have been actually four Iranian scientists that have been assassinated.
And widely believed to be have been carried out by Israeli intelligence operatives?
That's correct. And widely believed to have been carried out by Mossad. And this is one of the reasons why you get... And during the Bush administration, I should point out to you that George W. Bush said openly in a couple of speeches that the United States has intelligence operatives operating in Iran. We don't know who actually did these things. It's not clear. But the assassination of these individuals is widely thought to have benefited the people who are opposed to Iran's nuclear program in hopes of setting it back. And it also explains why Iran, from time to time, will arrest either Iranian Americans or, in the case of the three hitchhikers, Josh Fatal and Shane Bauer and Sarah Shurd, they'll accuse them of being spies, of being CIA spies. I think even the Iranians know that these people are not spies, but they're trying to point out to the fact that they know that there are spies in their country. There are operatives, and the operatives are doing real damage to the country.
And I think the United States' failure to condemn acts of terror fits in with our anti-Iranian rhetoric and would seem to be provocative and add to heightening tension.
You're 100% correct. And the United States, we now have, for instance, a move in Congress spearheaded by individuals like Ileana Ros-Lehtinen in Florida, a representative, to remove the terrorist designation for the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, or the MEK or MKO. This is a terrorist organization. They may be the ones who actually assassinated the Iranian scientists. And they are also the first individuals who tried to gin up the question about Iran making nuclear weapons for the United States in 2003. They were the ones that supplied the Bush administration with initial information about the about Iran enriching uranium. But the joke is, of course, that we always knew that Iran was enriching uranium because we started the Iranian program 40 years ago ourselves. And so the idea that it had somehow been carried out in secret just frankly revealed the extraordinary ignorance of the Bush administration in keeping tabs on the ongoing program.
I would say, Bill, that if you were to talk to 95%, maybe a higher number than that, of people in the United States, they would think that Iran is on the way to building a bomb and wants to get Israel. So we have a big problem, and that you're trying to address in an incredible way. But my broader question is, I've been following it, and not closely until, I really got to some of your stuff and seen how crazy it is. But I've been obviously completely concerned that they would do to Iran what they did to Iraq, although I think it's much harder. Iran is a really serious country. If they were to go after Iran, I think it just would be a conflagration in the Middle East. A lot's happening already, like these assassinations. But should we really be worried about where this is going?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, let me point out to you that the people who've been cheerleading for this kind of an attack on Iran have been doing so for, almost 20 years. These are people like Douglas Feith and Richard Perle and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Danielle Pletka and any number of people that we identify as neoconservatives. Already back in 1996, they authored a piece for then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on his in an earlier term for a complete reconfiguration of the Middle East that would result in security for Israel, and it involved in regime change in every single country in the Middle East, including the first country to go would have been Iraq, according to their plan, then Syria, and then finally Iran. So the plans to effect regime change in Iran have been on the books by this very powerful group of individuals who now inhabit the American Enterprise Institute, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and also AIPAC. And they lobby constantly. They have millions and millions of dollars of funds to put opinion pieces in papers. You see them all the time. They appear on the media, on radio and television, and they have a continual drumbeat for an attack against Iran. And the aim is not to stop Iran's nuclear program, because Iran's nuclear program is anemic. It is not likely to generate any kind of a weapon anytime soon. The aim is regime change. They want to see this current regime out of power.
It's noteworthy that this country has taken rather aggressive measures to pressure European and Asian countries to cut ties with Iran in an effort to choke off its oil exports and arguably to shut down the central bank.
Right. The latest move is to try to de-link Iran from the SWIFT system. And any of you who have ever had a money transfer from abroad know that you have to go through the SWIFT system is located in Belgium. And that would prevent Iran from making any transfers of money to North America or to the United States.
Yeah, so it's very serious. Now, I want two things, Bill, as we close. One, I want you to give us your website, because I want to tell our listeners there's incredibly well-written, easy-to-understand articles on that website. Bill, give us that website and any other thing you think we ought to do.
Certainly. Well, first of all, I mean, I should plug my book, which is The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs.
It's true.
How the United States and Iran demonize each other. The latest edition is University of Chicago Press, 2008. And the website is www.wbeeman.com.
Give it once more, Bill.
wbeeman.com.
Wonderful.
And any other thoughts of what activism people should do? I know you're a professor, you're a writer, so
I'd tell people that what they read in the New York Times, particularly if it's written by David Sanger or William Broad, they should take very, very skeptically. And also be very skeptical of the fact that the New York Times occasionally prints things on their editorial page, unsigned editorials. They go through as opinion. They present facts that are untrue. Whenever you hear of anybody who is appearing on the media from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy or the American Enterprise Institute talking about Iran, take everything they say with a grain of salt, because it's likely not to be true.
Good points.
Bill, thank you very much. It's really important. There's just so few news outlets now covering the information you're putting out.
Let me point out that the reason is because the people who really know something about this, we don't have the money, and we don't have the publicists to do this. And frankly, I don't have 24 hours a day to devote to this. But many of these places that are interested in trying to effect regime change in Iran are doing this 24/7.
All right. Well, we'll help get your word out, because it's so, so important.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being
with
us, Bill.
I really appreciate it.
Bye, Bill.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.